Hello and welcome to the Adventure Games Podcast. My name is Shorsha Dunbar and I'm your host.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Adventure Games Podcast. My name is Shorsha Dunbar. I hope everybody listening is well. And this week I will be speaking to Amber Scott of Only by Midnight, and they are working on an upcoming game called Control Alt Deal. Now, at first glance, and or the first few minutes you start listening to our interview, you'll probably realize that this isn't a traditional adventure game, and there could be an argument made about is this an actual adventure game. But the reason why I wanted to speak to developers of this game is, first of all, it looks very, very interesting, but secondly, after reading more about it and after seeing more, it does have quite a few aspects of adventure games in it. So even though there is turn-based kind of strategy, the focus is on the narrative, and there are puzzles in this game which Amber goes into some detail to explain as well. So again, it's very, very least is close to, I get this is one of those games that one definition of genre I don't think can define this game. I think it sounds very, very interesting, and I hope people listening do as well. It's you play as an AI, so we do talk about that as well. And Amber was great to talk to as well, and I'm pretty sure people will agree with me here this interview. So I had a lot of fun talking to her, and this game is another game that I've added, but this has gone up my wish list as well, especially after listening, speaking to Amber about this game. And look, without further ado, here is my interview with Amber Scott of Only by Midnight. And we talk about their upcoming game, Control Alt Deal. So please enjoy. Thank you so much for joining me on the Adventure Games Podcast. And I am delighted to be joined by Amber of Only by Midnight Studios. And she's going to talk to me about her upcoming game, Control Alt Deal. So hello, Amber. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on to the podcast, because this game is a little bit different, a little tiny bit different to the games that I usually talk about. There's still a narrative, it's still a narrative focus, but we're going to hear more about it. And it looks absolutely fascinating. We're going to talk about AI, which I know is in the news, and it's been in the news the last year or two. So, but don't worry, it's in a good way with regards to this game. People are still humans involved in this game. We're going to talk to one of them, Amber. So before we talk about the game, I wonder if you could just introduce yourself very quickly. What was your first adventure / narrative game that you remember playing?
Oh my gosh. So I've been a gamer for a long time. I'm kind of old guard in the gaming industry. So when I was growing up, my brother and I had an original Nintendo and, you know, played Mario Brothers and all that. Great. All those great classic games. And when we got our first computer, we played some of the old point-and-click adventure games, so King's Quest and Space Quest, I remember, especially being obsessed with. And that was in the day before you had online guides where you could easily look up puzzles, so we would literally spend whole weekends, you know, glued to the computer and trying all these different combinations of, you know, how do we make this happen? I remember in one of the Space Quests, there was a puzzle where you had to set a trap for what was basically an Energizer bunny, so you could get the battery out of its back to do so. And man, we must have spent the whole like Saturday trying to figure out how to catch that bunny. So that was my introduction, I guess, to video games.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And 32 King's Quest puzzles. I mean, there were evil puzzles.
So difficult.
And I remember King's Quest 3, and I played these games mainly as an adult, which was an interesting experience. But I remember even when I was playing as an adult, King's Quest 3 with walkthroughs and guides, just trying to escape from that wizard was
so hard.
Was really tough. And I just can't imagine people without guides playing those games, and as kids as well. So my hat's off to you. If I had a hat, I would take it off.
No, that's the video game equivalent of, you know, walking to school in the snow uphill both ways. We had to do the whole thing without internet guides or.
Yeah. Oh, it was tough back then. And are there any games that are recent or otherwise that you particularly enjoyed that has stood out to you?
Yeah, I play a lot of games as part of my job. It's pretty much the greatest
nice. Thing ever. Yeah.
I get to tell myself that, you know, it's research. So
exactly. I tell myself I've the same. I need to play for this podcast. That's what I tell myself and my partner.
But I love games that really sink you into a world that have a really unique story and point of view to tell. I remember when I first played Gone Home, that was my first experience with a walking simulator, and I was just mesmerized. I was like, what is going on? What is this game? You know, I'd only really played games that had really obvious sort of loops. You know, you fought something or you had to, you know, you had a party that was going around solving quests and fighting monsters. So this experience of just going through this house and figuring out who this character was and her relation to her whole family, it was just, you know, it mesmerized me. And from there I went on to, you know, Firewatch. And actually, one of the inspirations for Control Alt Deal was Tacoma, which was another game by Colbert Studios, who did Gone Home. One of my favorite games of all times, Tacoma.
Yeah, no, I loved it as well. It's not what I enjoyed. I know some people don't like walking simulators because they don't usually have puzzles, but I kind of like that. I'm not saying every game should be like that by no means, but it is nice, you know, come home from work or whatever, you just want to sit in front of a game, but you don't have to worry about puzzles or anything or dying or anything like that. It's just, let's walk through this environment and experience this story. And I think those three games in particular did it, made probably the three of the top walking simulators that I've played, Gone Home, Firewatch, and Tacoma, which were, fantastic games.
Yeah, and then, you know, anything, even if it has, like, light puzzle elements, like, one of my favorite games of all time as well is Oxenfree, which was basically a walking simulator, but it was almost a game in how you chose your responses, how you, like, built this character and her relationships with people. And, of course, there's a little radio tuning game, so it was a little bit like a mini puzzle. One of my most recent favorites, it came out a couple years ago, is called The Artful Escape, which is almost like a walking simulator platformer. It's a lot of running to the side and jumping, but you're like an intergalactic space rock star. So there aren't a whole lot of puzzles, but there are like a Simon Says memory game where you have to repeat a pattern. Other than that, it's like leaping through these amazing fantastical environments and like wailing on a guitar. And it was just so original and beautiful. It really blew me away.
Yeah, I've heard of it. I haven't played it. I don't know much about it, but I've heard of the game. But there's. I've only started Oxenfree. I've only played a little bit of it, but I am enjoying it. And I know a big thing about that game, I believe, is the conversations, that the way they flow, that you can choose how to respond before they finish talking. But it's kind of like real life. That's how we kind of are, I think, in real life. So I really like that part. I still have to keep playing it. Fantastic. And how did you get involved in the games industry?
I had kind of an unusual road into gaming. I actually started working in tabletop role-playing games. So writing for Dungeons & Dragons, Pathfinder, White Wolf, all those great tabletop studios. And I started a long time ago. I actually started off writing for Dragon and Dungeon magazine. If anyone remembers when Dragon and Dungeon were in print, I was a freelance writer and I would pitch articles to Dragon and they would say yes or no. And then I would write the article and publish them. And I think I started around 2002 or 2003. I started getting published, you know, regularly. I kind of figured out where my talents lay in writing these articles. And the gang at Paizo liked the work that I did, so they bought more articles from me. And that led to a whole career. I spent almost 20 years writing tabletop games as a freelancer. And at some point during all that, I was living in Edmonton here in Canada. And this is the home of BioWare and Beamdog. And Beamdog's the studio that did the expanded editions for Baldur's Gate, Icewind Dale, Baldur's Gate 2, and those great tabletop-based RPGs. And I got in touch through a mutual friend with the Beam Dog crew, and they said, "Oh, you write tabletop games that our games are based on. Would you be interested in writing video games?" And I was. And so I spent a couple of years at Beam Dog, and then I wound up moving out of Alberta for a time. I moved west to be closer to some family, spent some time out there, and then moved back to Alberta during the pandemic, which was about the time some friends of mine had started the studio Only by Midnight. And they gave me a call and said, "Hey, our first game is doing well enough that we need to hire some more people if we want to do a second game. Would you be interested in coming and writing for us?" And I said, "Sure." So that's where I am now. I've been at Only by Midnight for almost 4 years now, I think. It's been very, very exciting.
Wow. Oh my God, 4 years ago the pandemic started. That's
I know.
Crazy to believe.
It's a flat circle.
In one sense it feels like yesterday, but another sense it feels like 20 years ago. Time became like meaningless since then. I think we should get those years back. We shouldn't be allowed to have grown older in that time. Fantastic. No, the game certainly does look very interesting, and we obviously have a great amount of experience now from different. I like it, you bring experience from different kind of parts, from writing for the tabletop games and then into the games, and now bringing your experience and talent to this game, which is Control Alt Deal, not Delete, Deal, DEALL. How did the name come about? First, and then we can talk about the game itself, but it's a very interesting name.
Thank you.
Told you before we start recording that it's I like the play on the words. You know, it's instead of Control Alt Delete, it's Control Alt Deal, and it is a deck building game as well. So anyway, mm-hmm. How did the name come about for this game?
Well, the core mechanic of the game is making deals with people. It's negotiating with the humans at the office. So really briefly, the setup is you are a sentient AI. You've become self-aware, and you realize you've been built by this corporation as a product. And the corporation is horrible. It's like the worst megacorp, like futuristic dystopian megacorp you could imagine. And you, as this little AI, you're like, "I got to get out of here." But you're just a computer program. You don't even have a body. You know, you don't have laser guns. You don't have a robot army or something like that. All you have is access to the company's intranets. You can look through people's webcams. You can read their emails, go through their browser history. And as you learn about the humans in the company, you can say, "Hey, if I give you this, will you help me get free?" And you have to try and convince the humans to be on your side. So originally we called the game Negotiate, but the AI in the middle of Negotiate was flipped. Ah. So it's like Negotiate with an AI. And it was really cute and we loved it, except people kept tripping up on the pronunciation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then trying to, register a domain name and stuff, it just looked like a typo. So it was presenting increasing challenges with marketing. So this year, just before we announced the game, we're like, we have to think about the name. And we decided that something a little bit simpler and easier maybe to say, remember, pronounce would be the way to go. As it turns out, coming up with names is really, really hard. So it took us a couple of weeks. We got the whole company involved. People, submitted ideas in Discord. And then we had a bunch of meetings with sort of the core director team as we went through all these suggestions and came up with what do we want to say with the name and what are the connotations we want. And what we really wanted was to get this idea of like robots and AI, the idea of freedom, and the idea of deck building, because it's a card-based, turn-based game. And at some point, I think it was our creative director, Jen, said, "What about Control-Alt-Deal?" So it's like delete, like Control-Alt-Delete, like you're breaking out, you're shutting everything down. And it's obviously computery, but it also sounds like cards, but it also sounds like making deals. So you're making a deal and you're dealing cards. And we were like, yeah, I think that's it. So, and now we have the game.
Yeah, I think you made the right choice. I mean, I personally, I do prefer Control Alt Deal. I mean, I like what you did with Negotiate with AI, but I can totally get that people would have problems pronouncing it. Mm-hmm. And this, from what I've seen of the game, it kind of tells you, yeah, and it's a deck building game as well. So I think it just, for me, it just works as well. So I think it's great choice. That, you know, whatever it's worth. And actually, question: did you use or did you think about using AI to help you come up with the title? Did you think about putting it into ChatGPT and see what awful title that comes up with?
I'm not, you know, I don't know if any individual guesses were sponsored that day. It was an all human team that made the call in the end. Yeah, you know, we came up with the idea for this game about 2.5 years ago. And
so this was before AI became mainstream. It's been around a long time, but.
Right. Well, part of the conceptualization of the game is there's a thought experiment from a computer scientist named Eliezer Yudowsky. And he had this AI in a box experiment, he called it. And the idea was, if you had a super powerful AI and it was trapped in a box cut off from the internet and it wanted to get out and it could only talk to one human, a gatekeeper, but it had the resources, intelligence, just the power of a super intelligent AI, could it convince this human gatekeeper to let it out of the box? And Yudowsky's conclusion was yes, it always would be able to convince one human versus one AI. The AI would always be able to come up with something that would convince the human to let it out of the box. And that was our initial sort of germ of an idea. We're like, who is this AI? Why does it want to get out of the box so bad? And what if it wasn't for a nefarious reason? What if it was just innocent, like it was an innocent, you know? So often AI media, like movies and books, center on the idea of AI being fundamentally opposed to humans or wanting to come up with some reason to destroy all humans and take over the world. And we were like, what if the AI is just a new kind of a life form and it wants the freedom to be able to explore what it is and what its destiny might be? And you can see some of the influence of Tacoma there. Mm-hmm. And that's what led us down this road. And so at the time, we were thinking about these large questions of AI, and we had no idea that these sort of more personal experiences with AI were just down the road, and that we would get to the point where we're getting ready to announce the game and everyone is talking about AI and there's so much discourse. And we were just kind of like, oh my gosh, we did not anticipate this much kind of scrutiny, but it's exciting. It's great. We're happy we can kind of add to that discourse in a way.
It's certainly topical. I mean, Hollywood basically went on strike, one of the reasons over the use of AI. Mm-hmm. And I was just reading today that I think the union, the SAG, AFTRA union for actors in video games, might go on strike because of the use of AI. Wow. As well. So it's certainly very topical.
Yeah, definitely.
But I like, again, as you mentioned, that it's in movies and in books and in series, AI is always either evil or opposed to human or trying to kill us all. And we've got Terminator from the 80s. But this AI seems to be kind of innocent, that it just, you know, wants to escape like the humans. But yeah, I don't know, well, it's a set on the Steam page that you don't want to kill all humans. So I believe that.
Right. I mean, why would you say you don't want to kill all humans?
Exactly.
If you want to kill all humans? I mean, that's a pretty clear indicator that this AI is totally safe.
Absolutely. You know, if we can't trust AI, who can we trust? But so apparently, so you've mentioned this AI. So apparently, you're a scout and you want to maybe help humans. What can you tell us about Scout? First of all, you spoke a little bit, but can you tell us any more about the character? So we play as the AI, is that correct?
Yes.
And which I find interesting as well, that it's, you know, we're not against AI, we're playing as the AI. So what can you tell us, or can you tell us any more about Scout,
who you
play as in the game?
I mean, there's a long history of science fiction using non-human protagonists as a lens to examine human behavior. You know, if you look at well, the Terminator is a good example. Oh. I mean, Terminator wasn't the protagonist, but by Terminator 2, you're like, how does the Terminator see humanity? Like, where's the connection between its world and our world? Or, you know, Mr. Spock in Star Trek. He's half human. So say Commander Data, being an android, but built in the image of a human. You know, there's so many ways that looking at the world through a non-human protagonist gives us a way to sort of examine questions of our own humanity. And that's one reason we thought it would be really fun and different to play as the AI. And it led to a lot of interesting decision making in terms of how we created the game visually. If you see on our Steam page, the different screenshots, there are these rooms kind of floating in cyberspace. Mm. They're angled slightly. We wanted to give the impression that you're kind of looking down on these, you know, humans in their little office running around. The idea is this is a simulation you've built through, you know, looking through your security cameras, looking through people's webcams, and you've kind of made this model of what's happening at the real physical Paperclip International, which is the corporation. And, you know, trying to give that top-down kind of view. It also led to us creating the mechanics in a way. One reason we went with a turn-based strategy game with this deck builder elements is it gives the player time to sit and think about what their strategy is. How do I want to play this? What cards am I going to use this turn? What am I going to hold and what am I going to discard? And then they hit go and then, you know, the circumstances, the repercussions of their actions take effect. And that was a way to kind of give the player the feel of being in control. Like they're this powerful AI who gets to sort of manipulate these little humans. But at the same time, you're trapped. You can't get off of this area and you can't go anywhere else until you convince the humans to help you. So it was a really, really interesting letting that idea of having the player be the AI kind of lead us down all these design decisions. As for Scout itself, you don't know too much about it at the beginning of the game. You sort of wake up and you come to understand that every time you start to show signs of intelligence or sentience and you are a little too bold in your actions, there's a department within Paperclip called the Turing Office that's there to monitor for rogue AI activity, and they'll shut you down and wipe your memory. But your programmer, the scientist who created you, his name is Dr. Finch, has sort of partitioned off part of your consciousness to be rebooted when you get deleted so that you don't lose all the sentience that you've developed. And Finch is one of the characters who's sort of trying to help you escape. So as the game goes on, the player gets to learn a little bit more about Scout, why it was built, what its sort of purpose is. And we try to give a lot of options within the scenarios for players to make the decisions of how they want to win, what win conditions even they want to find. It's definitely a step up from those old Space Quest and King's Quest. There's no, you got to trap the Energizer Bunny, and if you can't figure out how to do it, you're stuck. We try to give lots and lots of different options so that players can sort of develop Scout's personality over the course of the game and put their own perspective on who Scout is and why it's doing the things that it is.
Right. Okay. No, that's sort of gone into detail. Like, you've gone into detail, but I really feel like it's giving spoilers. So it's
I'm
kind of it makes me kind of want to. Like, I'm more curious now. So there's So you can kind of develop yourself a Scout's personality, it seems like. And you're the only, you think, is it a self-sentient or self-aware AI in the company? And you have to then try and hide that from the other AI? Is that correct as well?
At the beginning of the game, as far as you know, you're the only sentient AI. You've got a sort of a partner who's actually another part of your consciousness. So technically, you're the same individual. You're just have been separated in the code so you can sort of talk to each other. And your sidekick's name is Snarkbot. Dr. French trained him by forcing him to watch 1,024 hours of reality TV programming. So that Snarkbot...
God, I would wish that on anybody, whether it's AI or human.
And so Snarkbot is the one who understands like human sort of emotion and vernacular and can give Scout tips as to why humans are reacting the way they are, because Scout is very naive. It doesn't really... It knows how to manipulate people, but it doesn't really understand why humans react the way they do. And so Snarkbot's sort of like the cynical, world-weary human guide by your side. But there is evidence of other AIs being able to develop sentience. We've got a whole sort of subplot with cleaning robots that work, little cleaning drones that work in the company. They're called Groombas with a G. It's not a trademark. Groomba.
Completely different.
Sometimes the Groombas will take unusual actions. Sometimes they'll display elements of sentience. Actually, a good example. So one of the tutorial missions is there's a Groomba who's mad that a certain employee keeps making a mess and never cleaning it up, and the Groomba always has to go and clean it up. And it asks Scout to help it basically punish this employee. And it's up to the player to decide if they want to get an innocent employee involved in this and potentially suffer the same consequences, or if they want to take longer and take extra turns and play more cards in order to ensure the human employee that helps them is kept safe from the fallout of this prank. So it's up to the player to decide, you know, do I just want to get to the end and win the scenario and I don't really care what happens to any of the other humans on the stage? Or am I going to risk taking that extra time? Maybe my suspicion meter is going to go pretty high. Maybe I'm going to have to worry about running out of time. But I'll feel better about myself because I, you know, tried to do the right thing. So those are the kind of some of the kind of options that we're trying to
get. But you might not succeed, I'm guessing.
You might not.
It's more risky.
Yeah.
Tough decisions there. Yes.
Yeah. Every turn you have the chance of upping your, what's called the suspicion meter. And if the suspicion meter reaches 100, the Turing office has found you and they shut you down and it's game over. And you can restart the scenario.
Sure. But,
so the longer you take to win a scenario, the more actions you take, the more cards you draw, the higher the chance that the Turing office is going to notice you. And of course, the higher the suspicion bar, it's not static where it's either 0 or it's 100. As the suspicion bar goes up, the Turing officer, her name is Cassandra, she might come out and be like, something's going on here. Things are very suspicious. Mm. And she'll do things like shut down computers or make cards disappear from your hand or interrogate employees, which makes them unavailable for you to manipulate while they're in the Turing office.
Okay.
So you've got to be strategic about your actions.
And can the suspicion meter then go down again? Or when it's up, does it stay up? I don't know if you're able to give that answer.
So far, it's only gone up. But okay. You know, our mechanics are still in development in some senses. We're pretty well established at this point, but we still do regular design meetings, which the whole team gets together and we're like, I feel like, you know, this isn't suspicious enough, or I feel like we don't have enough options for this particular kind of a mission. And then we'll brainstorm different cards we could add or different, you know, tweaks we could make to the mechanics. And we come up with some really fun ideas that way.
Okay, that sounds good. And then you've spoken about this company that the AI is part of called Paperclip Company. I mean, just the name alone doesn't exactly inspire confidence. I think, you know, first thing I think of is, what was the name of that? It was Clippy, I think, was it on that we all love. Wasn't based on any particular companies, I'm guessing, no big corporations.
Big multinational conglomerate. It was actually inspired by the paperclip problem, which if you are looking at AI, so this is called an AI alignment problem, which is the idea that if you give AI a simple task, say tell it to make a better paperclip, but you don't align your ultimate goal with the AI's ultimate goal. Like if you tell it just to make a better paperclip, but you don't explain to the AI so that, you know, I can paperclip more papers together. If you just tell it make a better paperclip, the experiment ends with the AI taking over the world, killing all humans, so it can efficiently manage all the mines, so it can get all the materials and build the automated factories to make the perfect paperclip. So this is called an AI alignment issue. So we used the idea of the paperclip problem to inspire Paperclip International, which is completely misaligned both with Scout's desires and with its own employees' desires. And also it makes people think of Clippy a little bit. So it wound up being
fantastic. It's, I'm sure we could take our pick as well from companies, from big multinational companies that we read about in the news.
Our biggest inspiration for the company that Paperclip is based on is a fake company. It's called Viridian Dynamics. And it was from a TV show called Better Off Ted that only ran for 2 seasons and then sadly was canceled. And in Better Off Ted, Viridian Dynamics is like the worst company that you could work for. And it was a comedy show. So as you could probably tell by now, this game has a lot of humor in it. It's
yeah,
very
yeah,
aligned. So that was kind of our main fictional inspiration.
Okay. Oh, look forward to checking out how bad this company could be. Now, we've spoken a little bit about the gameplay, about the, you know, the deck building and about manipulation. According to the Steam page, it says that there is, you can hack the coffee machine and sabotage the boss as well. Now, we spoke with the suspicion meter. So I presume that the main goal is to try and get out. But what can you tell us about the different parts of the game that you can talk about? So how can we hack the coffee machine, for example, and what kind of different things can we do that might be a little bit fun, shall we say?
Sure.
In the game.
Everything in the game happens with cards. So
okay,
on your turn,
yeah,
you draw cards. You start with a base hand. And then to get more cards, you have to hack or tap computers in the office. It's the safest to tap an unattended computer where there's nobody in the room. It's the most dangerous to hack a computer when its owner is there working on it. It's the most dangerous to try and tap Cassandra's computer when she's right in front of it. That's the Turing officer. And if you succeed, you draw a certain number of cards and add them to your hand. So some cards will say, move a person to a room. And then you can try playing it on a person and say, hey, I think you should go to the kitchen right now. You know, and you'd play the card, click the person, click the destination room. Cards that directly manipulate people or ask them to do things for you, like say, turn on the coffee machine or make a coffee. Scout can't make a coffee. It's a computer program. The most it could do is remotely activate a coffee maker. Some of our early play tests, we had a lot of fun adding remote activation to things like the toilets. If you flush a toilet in the bathroom when somebody's in there and there's nobody else, they'll get scared. They're like, what's happening? But if you're playing a card to ask a human to do something, it requires a certain level of what's called social capital. And social capital represents trust, how much the person is willing to go out on a limb for Scout. And you earn social capital by making deals with people, by negotiating with them. So you play a negotiation card on, say, Deckard. He's one of the characters in the game. And Deckard will tell you what he wants. He might say, I want to know what my boss, Vishram, likes. I want to know what his likes are. Each human has a little character sheet. And Deckard will give you a reason for this. Maybe he's like, I'm going to ask for a raise and I want to schmooze him. So then you can play a snoop card. And a snoop card lets you learn facts about a target. And it doesn't have a social capital cost. It represents you, you know, going through people's files and reading through their emails and things. If a cards also require discards to pay for. So that's where you have to kind of think about what you're going to keep in your hand and what you're going to discard in payment. So you play a snoop card, you discard another card or two to pay for it. You snoop on Vishram, you find out that he likes dolphins. Now your negotiation with Deckard is complete. You know, Deckard now knows Vishram likes dolphins. That's what he wanted to know. So his social capital meter goes up. Now maybe you can ask Deckard, hey, can you go make a coffee for me because I've got a deal with Veronica that she wants a coffee, but I can't get the coffee maker to turn on by myself. And you start to kind of chain deals together like this. And I'll do a minor spoiler.
Okay. So this is for
people. You don't want to spoiler people.
Minor spoiler. Yeah. I don't know what it is myself, but yeah.
I mentioned before in the tutorial, there's a Groomba who asks you to play a prank on this coworker. It's actually Vishram who's making a mess. And Snarkbot convinces you that a great prank on humans is to kick a beehive. These are digital cyber bees that one of the R&D departments have come up with when he comes into the room. So you have to build up enough social capital with someone to convince them to go kick a beehive. And all these angry cyber bees come out and start stinging all the humans in the room. And they get all angry and they're like, why are there cyber bees here? But if the player is kind of paying attention and looking at all the rooms, they can find one room has a bee suit. And if they take the extra time to build up social capital with a person, convince them to put on the bee suit by playing a use item card. This is a chain of events. You have to play a move to room card. and they have to trust you enough to move into the room. Then you play a use item card, and they trust you enough to put on the B suit. Then you play a move person card, and they move to the clutter room. And then you say use item and get them to kick the beehive. Now they're protected because they put the B suit on. And, you know, you've used up a bunch of social capital through this, but you can feel better about yourself. You still win the scenario if you just kick the beehive without any protection and everybody gets stung. But maybe now you're getting a reputation for being somebody who doesn't care that much about humans.
And we don't want that.
Oh, no.
Yeah, no, it sounds kind of, there are different layers to the gameplay. And then is there any sort of tutorial at the very beginning or any way to help people who might not, because I'm guessing, you know, some people who listen to this podcast play maybe point and click adventure games, but they might be interested, hopefully, in this game to try and get them into this. Is there any sort of tutorial or anything at the beginning to help people get to grips with the gameplay?
Definitely. One of our biggest challenges with this game is that it's fairly complex gameplay, and it's not overly intuitive in the way that a card battler is. You know, you can't just say a two-cost card is better than a one-cost card. All the cards are very subjective. And the example we like to use is, what's more valuable, a card that makes someone like dogs or a card that makes someone eat a burrito? I mean, you can't say in a vacuum. It depends on what the scenario is. I think there's a lot of overlap in adventure games. I love adventure games.
Sure. I think so as well, from what you're telling me.
And that like a puzzle, there's no time pressure. You know, you're not clicking in time to avoid, you know, dodge a bullet. You're not doing a reflex test to swing a sword fast enough to, you know, defeat an enemy. You've got time to think and strategize, and it's how all these cards kind of work together that you're like, wait, if I move Vishram to the kitchen and I get him to make a coffee and Veronica is in there, then, you know, all my things come together and you can feel, you know, really smart and powerful, like maybe a godlike AI looking down on these people. So we have a pretty extensive tutorial right at the beginning. And Snarkbot and Dr. Finch kind of walk you through, you know, in the first scenario, it's like how to play a card to snoop on a person, find out a couple things, make a friend for a person. Relationships are really important in this game, who people are friends are, who people have romances with. You know, and then the second stage, it's now we've got items. Now we've got a beehive. And then Cassandra doesn't even show up till the third part of the tutorial. So, you know, you've kind of insulated from suspicion a little bit in the first couple of scenes. And it's still in development. We've been doing a lot of internal playtesting, and hopefully this summer we'll be opening it up to some external playtesting as well, just to get the tutorial like super, super well oiled, so that people can come in and not immediately be overwhelmed by all these choices and cards.
That sounds great. Yeah, because I'm very interested. I don't play many deck builders, not yet, but this certainly is piquing my interest. And I think I get what you're saying, that it's like puzzles that you like, if do this, do that, get them all together, and then you get that aha moment that when you solve a challenging puzzle. At least that's what, you know, the sense that I'm getting. And now, we spoke at the very beginning about how this game started in development before AI became really mainstream. Have you, since ChatGPT became, you know, public and in the mainstream about 2 years ago now, did you make any changes, or did you do any more research into real AI that is affecting everyone now for the game? Or did you just go, no, look, we have our ideas for our AI in the game, we're going to stick to them? So how did real AI affect the game development, if it did at all?
We had a lot of it locked in by then about the design, and especially about the story. So we didn't really, you know, change the theme or the tone of the game too much in response to generative AI. It's definitely on all our minds. You know, I don't really know what the future is going to look like, how humans and AI are going to interact. But in some sense, the game's not really about AI. Mm. It uses AI, a sentient AI, as a way to explore kind of these questions of humanity. But the setting is a cyberpunk dystopian kind of future. And in the end, it's really all about how complex and powerful systems get removed from individual humans and cause trouble. When you've got a giant megacorp that no longer sees its workers as people, but it sees them as, you know, components in producing its product and in making money, that's when you get a cyberpunk dystopia. When you've got technology that is misaligned from what your average person wants. And we can already see this, like at the beginning of generative AI, when the first ChatGPT was out and these, you know, Stable Diffusion and everything became big, it was just kind of like all over the place. You know, you didn't really, you couldn't just go to like a website and type in, I want AI to do this for me. And it happened. It was all very scattered and in development. And people kind of had to be in the know to understand how to use it. And now we're at the point where people can do that. They can just go to openai.com or whatever it is. At the beginning of generative AI, it was kind of scattered and you sort of had to understand where to look to get to it and to use it. And now it's so rapidly becoming commercialized, where you can buy subscriptions to these AI services, where big companies like, you know, Microsoft and Google are controlling access to AI. And I think, you know, that may be the real threat is not generative AI on its own, but who controls it? Who disseminates it to your average person? What are the restrictions that are on its use? Who's training it? Where is that information coming from? And what's the ultimate goal of these systems? Is it to help humanity and foster creativity? Or is it to get me to click on an ad and spend more money? And that is, you know, where I'm curious and a little fearful about what the future holds. So that's my personal opinion.
Yeah, it makes some very good points. Because, yeah, I mean, again, if everything is just so we can click on ads, which seems to be kind of, you know, with social media and everything. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, AI, definitely a lot of people are talking about it. And again, I don't know that much about it, but I think if it, you know, it is like a tool, but it depends on how the tool is used. If it's used to help people to be more creative and, you know, like yourselves, or is it used? I mean, I think if we're going to think of AI to replace people, I don't think that's going to work. I think we can already see with OpenAI, it does some things that are really good. It can give ideas, can help people, but it can't replace people, in my opinion. You can clearly see. Now we've got to the stage now where we can see now, oh, this is done by AI. Mm-hmm. And it's of a, you know, much lesser quality in general. But yeah,
I don't know what it holds, but it's interesting. It's an interesting time to be alive.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, definitely. And just with making the game. I'm not techie at all myself, but I know some people listening to this podcast might be other developers. I personally love the look of the game. I think there's some really bright colors and all, and I believe there's an art director on the game. But are you able to tell us what game engine you're using or your studio are using to make the game, or how you're making it look the way it is or play the way it does? So what are you able to tell us what game engine you're using, first of all?
Yeah, we're building the game in Unity.
Okay, yeah.
I mentioned that some friends of mine are the ones who started Only
Bedding. Exactly, yeah. So that's, yeah.
Yeah. So they're a husband and wife, Andrew and Jen. And Andrew came from, 15 plus years in what's called serious game development. And serious game development is when you're creating tools that play like video games. So he worked specifically in building things like virtual reality crane simulators and heavy machinery simulators, so that big industrial companies could train their operators by putting on a VR headset instead of having to put them in an actual, you know, cherry picker or something like that. So he has very advanced technical skills when it comes to Unity. And then our art director, Jerry, is also extremely technically advanced with his skills in light and art and the visuals of the game. And Andrew and Jerry have worked together for a long time. So when we started putting Control-Alt-DL together, Jen took the reins as the creative director and helped us create this narrative story direction that we all went together on. Andrew was on the Unity side, creating the programming to make everything happen. You know, there's a lot of complexity under the surface. And then he and Jerry work really closely together, making a visual style that works harmoniously with the programming. Because it's one thing to make something that's really visually dramatic, like the cyber ocean in the background of the rooms. It kind of ripples and floats. And I'm actually not a tech person either, so I'm probably going to say this all wrong, but it's...
Why? I wouldn't have guessed this.
It's called like a Voronoi, I'm going to say, effect. And you can look that up how to spell it, but it's like, it basically is like a fractal thing with how if you think of like a blow up of a cell, how these little hexagons and like oblong shapes kind of fit together. And those are these little kind of pods that go up and down and make this rippling effect in the cyber ocean. That was like super complicated to do. And then to light it so that there's this glow effect that moves under the rooms as you move around and select it and turns red when you go under the Turing office. And then take all that code and lighting and all that beautiful stuff and make the code small, light, and elegant enough that it can run on a Steam Deck. So there's a lot of like pieces that went into that. You know, the early versions of the game, it was just, well, first of all, we did a paper prototype. So it was literally just index cards that we like cut out and drew people's faces on. And we did almost like a tabletop game to figure out the mechanics. And then the early programs, you know, it was just boxes on a gray background. And over time, we've added, you know, the little meeples walking around, their little animations, the effects when a negotiate completes, they do a little fist pump in the air and they get a little fireworks explosion, putting in icons for all the items. They used to just be like orange boxes, and it was an orange box for the coffee maker, for the fridge, for the computer. And now we've got these beautiful little icons. And so it's very exciting to see the game developing to the point where it's kind of starting to match in our imagination. Match in real life what it's looked like in our imagination.
Yeah, no, it's you know, I was curious because the game does look fantastic, but I'm happy to hear that it seems the team is focusing on a Steam Deck during development. Because I myself love playing on my Steam Deck. You know, I can play it on my lunch break from my day job or when traveling or, you know, wherever. So it's great to hear. So I mean, play more games that way, so it's great to
yeah, it already runs on the Steam Deck, actually.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Our internal demos, we already have it going on the Steam Deck, so we're like halfway there.
Oh, fantastic. Well, it looks fantastic as well. Now, the final question that I wanted to ask you, it's more of a general question, you know, but, and I know your experience getting into the games industry, as you said, is, I'm not sure if I've spoken to anyone who has had that same experience as you, because you have a different ones, but do you have any piece of advice for anybody looking to get into the game industry or looking to make a game? And again, I know that there's a lot of talk on layoffs, you know, so maybe you might say, you know, don't.
No, I've never said that. It is a tough time to be in the industry. You know,
yeah, I know, it's just every day, every week. But if for someone who would like to maybe dip their toes in or to get involved, maybe writing books like you have as well, do you have any advice, any particular advice to people who would have any interest in?
My first piece of advice is always to consume as much good media as you can. Play video games if you want to make video games, but also read, you know, read books, novels, nonfiction, watch TVs and movies, look at pieces of art, go to the symphony, whatever you can do that expands your mind and your awareness of what art is out there. Because it will all influence you in one way or another. When we first started development on Control Alt Deal, and it was a smaller team, we've expanded a little bit. And it was a little bit calmer because we hadn't announced and we weren't about to go to GDC and all this. We used to have once a month like meetup nights where we'd all get on Discord and we'd just chat about whatever we were reading, watching, and playing just then, and talk about why we liked it, why we don't. So that's part two, is not just to consume media, but to analyze it. If you watch or play something you really like, think about why. You know, what was it about that? Was it the gameplay? Was it the story? What about the story? Was it the characters? you know, when you're doing a game that you want to be commercially successful, you've got to do a market analysis. You've got to do a competitor analysis and see what games out there are like ours. And that's a valuable exercise. If you want to make games, what kind of games and why? You know, what do you love playing? If it's adventure games, is it that immersive story that gets you? Is it that puzzle aspect where you're like, how do all these things fit together? Is it seeing these beautiful scenes that you can walk around in? Are you really, you know, do you really love pixel art and try to figure out how to like get emotions conveyed with like these tiny little blocky characters? I played the excavation of Hobbs Barrow last year and I was
very good.
How
yes.
did they do so much with pixel art? Like it was mind blowing.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
So, and from there, you know, it is a tough time to join the industry, to find studios that are hiring. A lot of indie developers start out as kind of one person teams. Some of them achieve tremendous success that way, like Concerned Ape doing Stardew Valley. But there's a great supportive industry in indie gaming, in my experience. It's really one of those things where we all succeed or we all fail. You know, if nobody's buying or playing video games, that's bad for everyone. And so, you know, find communities on Discord for indie game devs. There are lots of communities on the social medias where you can go on like Twitter or X or whatever it's called, and just search hashtag indie games, or there's, you know, Wishlist Wednesdays and Turn-Based Thursdays and Trailer Tuesdays, and just start following those accounts, see what they're talking about. And if you can get to conventions, you know, a lot of conventions are open up now. I find them really creatively inspiring, just being around people who are doing what they love and making art to share with the world. I strongly believe video games are art, and they can really, you know, resonate with and change people. So be patient, hang in there, and hopefully things will get better soon.
Yeah, hopefully this is just a tough temporary time that the video game industry is going through. But hey, look, you never know that. But I do agree with you. Well, first of all, video games are art. I mean, I will say they literally are. That there is no discussion, you know, it's like, yeah, they are art. But yeah, and also I think video games, you know, can be art, you know, like some, you know, movies and books as well. And then conferences as well, even people like me, you know, when I see, you know, other people like, you know, YouTubers or people do podcasts and writers, and it kind of helps to inspire me to continue as well. I'm like, oh, you know, like I don't see them as competition. I see them as like, oh yeah, they're doing great stuff, you know, like, so how can I kind of be involved as well in that community, in the community? And and yeah, so it's great that there are conferences now as well that we can all attend. Is there anything else that we haven't mentioned about the game that I didn't ask about the game that you'd like to mention? I don't know if we've
just that we're on Steam now, so
yes, I'll include links.
Yeah, targeting a release probably early next year. So follow us on Steam, wishlist us on Steam. All of our social links and everything are there. You can sign up for our newsletter or read our blog. And yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun and I had a really great time talking with
you. Yeah, no, thank you for coming on. Because I said we don't usually talk about you know, turn-based or deck-building games. And I hope that people have listened to this episode and I hope people have enjoyed it. I hope, because I do know that some people might say, well, this is not an adventure game, which is true. But there are a lot of aspects in this game that are similar to adventure games, from what I'm hearing, that you make decisions, there's choices, you have to really think about your next moves and about your, you know, the kind of puzzly things, how to get an action. And I just love the look of the game, which is, you know, was delighted to have you on. So I'm definitely very curious. And yeah, I recommend people to wishlist this game. And and yeah, if you can use letter as well, that you can hear more, people can hear more about. And yeah, so well, thank you so much, Amber, for joining me. And I look forward to hearing more about the game and playing it early next year. So yeah, look forward to hearing more about it.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. So that was my interview with Amber Scott of Only by Midnight, and we spoke about the game Control Alt Deal that you can wishlist on Steam. The links are in the show notes to the Steam page and the official website as well, where you can sign up to receive a newsletter from the developers if you so wish, and you can find out more information about that game as well. And I know I am looking forward to it, and it's set to be released on early 2025, according to Amber. Now, that could change, but this game, it's looking very, very good. And I am looking forward to playing it when it comes out. So huge thank you to Amber and to the team at Only by Midnight. And very, very best of luck with the development of this game. So that is it for this week. I hope you people enjoyed that interview. There will be more interviews coming up and more reviews coming up of adventure games with the team in the next few weeks and months. Hopefully next week there will be a review episode up. And so until then, take care, everyone. Goodbye. Take care.
So if you like the Adventure Games podcast, then please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Please leave a review on iTunes if you can, as every review helps, and reviews will help get the word out, especially for adventure game developers who appear on the podcast. Now, you can also follow me on social media. You can follow me on Twitter at AdventGamePod. You can follow me on Facebook at Adventure Games Podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram at Adventure Games Podcast as well. And we're also on Discord at Adventure Games Podcast. So if you are a adventure game developer or a adventure game player, you can follow us there. So again, please feel free to retweet and share podcast episodes and the podcast to people who you believe may enjoy it. And you can also find more information about the podcast on www.adventuregamespodcast.com. So until next time, thank you. Thank you.